So, in the general sense, Sex and Vampires 101, we all started out human, Beau, and most of those human desires are still there, just obscured behind more powerful desires. But we're not thirsty all the time, and we tend to form very strong bonds, physical as well as emotional. Royal and Eleanor are just like any human couple who are attracted to each other, by which I mean very, very annoying for those of us who have to live with them, and even more so for the one who can hear their minds. I laughed quietly, and she joined in. Awkward, I murmured. You have no idea, she said darkly, then sighed. And now, in the specific sense, Sex and Vampires 102, Beau and Edith. She sighed again, more slowly this time. I don't think that would be possible for us, because I would have to get too close, I guessed. That would be a problem, but that's not the main problem. Beau, you don't know how, well, fragile you are. I don't mean that as an insult to your manliness. Anyone human is fragile to me. I have to mind my actions every moment that we're together so that I don't hurt you. I could kill you quite easily, simply by accident. I thought about the first few times that she'd touched me, how cautiously she'd moved, how much it had seemed to frighten her, how she would ask me to move my hand rather than just pulling hers out from under it. Now she put her palm against my cheek. If I were too hasty, if I were at all distracted, I could reach out, meaning to touch your face, and crush your skull by mistake. You don't realize how incredibly breakable you are. I can never, never afford to lose any kind of control when I'm with you. If her life were in my hands that way, would I have already killed her? I cringed at the thought. I think I could be very distracted by you, she murmured. I am never not distracted by you. Can I ask you something now? Something potentially offensive? It's your turn. Do you have any experience with sex and humans? I was a little surprised that my face didn't go hot again. It felt natural to tell her everything. Not even a little bit. This is all firsts for me. I told you, I've never felt like this about anyone before. Not even close. I know. It's just that I hear what other people think. I know that love and lust don't always keep the same company. They do for me. That's nice. We have that one thing in common, at least. Oh. When she'd been talking before, about how we tend to form very strong bonds, physical as well as emotional, I couldn't help but wonder if she was speaking from experience. I found that I was surprisingly relieved to know that wasn't the case. So you do find me distracting? Indeed. She was smiling again. Would you like me to tell you the things that distract me? You don't have to. It was your eyes first. You have lovely eyes, Beau. Like a sky without clouds. I've spent all my life in rainy climates, and so I often miss the sky. But not when I'm with you. Thanks? She giggled. I'm not alone. 6 of your 10 admirers started with your eyes, too. 10? They're not all so forward as Taylor and Michaela. Do you want a list? You have options. I think you're making fun of me. And either way, there is no other option. And never would be again. Next, it was your arms. I'm very fond of your arms, Beau. This includes your shoulders and hands. She ran her hand down my arm, then back up to my shoulder and back down to my hand again. Or maybe it was your chin that was second. Her fingers touched my face, like she thought I might not know what she meant. I'm not entirely sure. It all took me quite by surprise when I realized that not only did I find you delicious, but also beautiful. My face and neck were burning. I knew it couldn't be true, but in the moment she was pretty convincing. Oh, and I didn't even mention your hair. Her fingernails combed against my scalp. Okay, now I know you're making fun. I'm truly not. Did you know your hair is just precisely the same shade as a teak inlaid ceiling in a monastery I once stayed at in, I think it would be Cambodia now. No, I did not. I yawned involuntarily. She laughed. Did I answer your question to your satisfaction? Yes. Then you should sleep. I'm not sure if I can. Do you want me to leave? No, I said a little too loudly. She laughed, then began to hum that same unfamiliar lullaby. Her voice was like an angel's, soft in my ear. More tired than I realized, exhausted from a day of mental and emotional stress like I'd never felt before, I drifted to sleep with her cold body in my arms. Chapter 15. The Cullens. The muted light of another cloudy day eventually woke me. I lay with my arm across my eyes, groggy and dazed. Something, a dream trying to be remembered, struggled to break into my consciousness. I moaned and rolled on my side, hoping more sleep would come. And then yesterday came flooding back into my memory. Oh! I sat up so fast it made my head spin. Your hair also has the ability to defy gravity. Her amused voice came from the rocking chair in the corner. It's like your own superpower. Automatically, I reached up to pat my hair down. She sat cross-legged in the chair, a perfect smile on her perfect face. You stayed. It was like I hadn't woken up after all. Of course. That's what you wanted, correct? I nodded. She smiled wider. It's what I wanted, too. I staggered out of the bed, not sure where I was going, only that I needed to be closer to her. She waited for me, and there was no surprise in her face when I sank to my knees in front of her. I reached up slowly and laid my palm against the side of her face. She leaned into my hand, her eyes slipping closed. Charlie? I asked. We'd both been speaking at a normal volume. He left an hour ago, with an amazing amount of gear. He'd be gone all day, so it was just me and Edith, in an empty house, with no need to go anywhere. So much time. I felt like some crazy old miser, gloating over his piles of gold coins. Only instead of coins, it was seconds that I hoarded. It was only then that I realized she'd changed her clothes. Instead of the thin-strapped tank top, she wore a peach-colored sweater. You left? I asked. She opened her eyes and smiled, putting one of her hands up to keep mine against her face. I could hardly leave in the clothes I came in. What would the neighbors think? In any case, I was only gone for a few minutes, and you were very deeply asleep at that point, so I know I didn't miss anything. I groaned. What did I say? Her eyes got a little wider, her face more vulnerable. You said you loved me, she whispered. You already knew that. It was different hearing the words. I stared into her eyes. I love you, I said. She leaned down and rested her forehead carefully against mine. You are my life now. We sat like that for a long time, until finally my stomach grumbled. She sat up, laughing. Humanity is so overrated, I complained. Should we begin with breakfast? I threw my free hand over my jugular, my eyes wild. She flinched. Then her eyes narrowed and she scowled at me. I laughed. Come on, you know that was funny. She was still frowning. I disagree. Shall I rephrase? Breakfast time for the human? Okay, I need another human minute first, if you don't mind. Of course. Stay. She smiled. I brushed my teeth twice again, then rushed through my shower. I ripped through my wet hair with a comb, trying to make it lie flat. It ignored me pretty thoroughly. And then I hit a wall. I'd forgotten to bring clothes with me. I hesitated for a minute, but I was too impatient to panic long. There was no help for it. I tucked the towel securely around my waist and then marched into the hall with my face blazing red. Even better, the patch of red on my chest was exposed, too. I stuck my head around the edge of the doorframe. She was still in the rocking chair. She laughed at my expression. Shall we meet in the kitchen, then? Yes, please. She was past me in a rush of cool air, down the stairs before a second had passed. I was barely able to follow the motion. She was just a streak of pale color, then nothing. Thanks, I called after her, then hurried to my dresser. I knew I should probably put some thought into what I wore, but I was in a hurry to get downstairs. I did think to grab a pullover, so she wouldn't worry about me getting cold. I raked my fingers through my hair to calm it again, then ran down the stairs. She was leaning against the counter, looking very at home. What's for breakfast? I asked. That threw her for a minute. Her brows pulled together. I'm not sure. What would you like? I laughed. That's all right. I fend for myself pretty well. You're allowed to watch me hunt. I got a bowl and a box of cereal. She returned to the chair she'd sat in last night, watching as I poured the milk and grabbed a spoon. I set my food on the table, then paused. The empty space in front of her on the table made me feel rude. Can I get you anything? She rolled her eyes. Just eat, Beau. I sat at the table, watching her as I took a bite. She was gazing at me, studying my every movement. It made me self-conscious. I swallowed so I could speak, wanting to distract her. Anything on the agenda today? Maybe, she said. That depends on whether or not you like my idea. I'll like it, I promised as I took a second bite. She pursed her lips. Are you open to meeting my family? I choked on my cereal. She jumped up, one hand stretched toward me helplessly, probably thinking about how she could crush my lungs if she tried to give me the Heimlich. I shook my head and motioned for her to sit while I coughed the milk out of my windpipe. I'm good, I said when I could speak. Please don't do that to me again, Beau. Sorry. Maybe we should have this conversation after you're done eating. Okay. I needed a minute anyway. She was apparently serious, and I guess I'd already met Archie and it hadn't been that bad. And Dr. Cullen, too. But that had been back before I'd known Dr. Cullen was a vampire, which changed things. And while I had known with Archie, I didn't know if he knew that I knew, and that felt like kind of an important distinction to me. Also, Archie was the most supportive, according to Edith. There were others who were obviously not as generous. I finally done it, she murmured when I swallowed the last bite and pushed the bowl away. What did you do? Scared you. I thought about that for a moment, then held up my hand, fingers spread, and waved it from side to side in the international symbol for kinda yeah. I wouldn't let anyone hurt you, she assured me. But that just made me worry more that someone, royal, would want to, and she would get in between to rescue me. I didn't care what she said about holding her own and not fighting fair. That idea really freaked me out. No one would try, Beau. That was a joke. I don't want to cause you any problems. Do they even know that I know? She rolled her eyes. Oh, they're quite up to date. It's not really possible to keep secrets in my house, what with our various parlor tricks. Archie had already seen that your dropping by was a possibility. I could feel a variety of expressions rippling across my face before I could control it. What all did Archie see? Yesterday? Last night? My face got hot. I saw her eyes narrow, the way they did when she was trying to read my mind. Just thinking about what Archie might have seen, I explained before she could ask. She nodded. It can feel invasive, but he doesn't do it on purpose. And he sees so many different possibilities, he doesn't know which will happen. For example, he saw over 100 different ways that yesterday could have gone, and you only survived about 75% of the scenarios. Her voice got very hard at the last part. Her posture brittle. They'd taken bets, you know, as to whether I would kill you. Oh. Her expression was still rigid. Do you want to know who sided for and against? Maybe not. Tell me after I meet them. I don't want to go into this prejudiced. Surprise erased the anger from her face. Oh. You'll go then? It seems like the respectful thing to do. I don't want them to think I'm shady. She laughed, a long, bell-like peal. I couldn't help but smile. Does that mean I get to meet Charlie too then? She asked eagerly. He's already suspicious, and I'd rather not be shady either. I mean, sure, but what should we tell him? I mean, how do I explain? She shrugged. I doubt he'll struggle too hard with the idea of your having a girlfriend. Though it's a loose interpretation of the word girl, I'll admit. Girlfriend, I mumbled. It sounds not enough. Mostly it sounded transitory, something that didn't last. She stroked one finger down the side of my face. Well, I don't know if we need to give him all the gory details, but he will need some explanation for why I'm around here so much. I don't want Chief Swan putting a restraining order on me. Will you really be here? I asked, suddenly anxious. It seemed too good to be true. Something only a fool would count on. As long as you want me. I'll always want you, I warned her. I'm talking about forever here. She put her fingers against my lips and her eyes closed. It was almost like she wished I hadn't said that. Does that make you sad? I asked, trying to put a name to the expression on her face. Sad seemed closest. Her eyes opened slowly. She didn't answer. She just stared into my eyes for a long time. Finally, she sighed. Shall we? I glanced at the clock on the microwave automatically. Isn't it a little Wait, forget I asked that. Forgotten. Is this okay? I wondered, gesturing to my clothes. Should I dress up more? You look... She suddenly dimpled up. Delicious. So you're saying I should change? She laughed and shook her head. Never change, Beau. Then she stood and took a step toward me, so that her knees were pressed against mine. She put her hands on either side of my face and leaned down till her face was just an inch from mine. Carefully, she reminded me. She tilted her head to the side and closed the distance between us. With the lightest pressure, her lips touched mine. Carefully, I shouted in my head. Just don't move. My hands balled into fists. I knew she would feel the blood pulsing into my face. Slowly, her lips moved against mine. As she got more sure of herself, her lips were firmer. I felt them part slightly, and her breath washed cool across my mouth. I didn't inhale. I knew how her scent made me do stupid things. Her fingers stroked from my temples to my chin, and then hooked under my jaw and pulled my lips tighter to hers. "Careful," I shouted at myself. And then, out of nowhere, the dizzy, hollow ringing sounds started up in my ears. At first, I couldn't concentrate on anything but her lips. But then I started to fall down the tunnel, and her lips were getting farther and farther away. "Bo? Bo?" "Hey," I tried to say. "What happened? Are you all right?" The sound of her anxiety helped bring me around. I wasn't totally gone, so it was fairly easy. I took two deep breaths and opened my eyes. "I'm fine," I told her. She was leaning away, but her arms were stretched out to me. One hand was cold on my forehead, the other on the back of my neck. Her face looked paler than usual. "Just kind of forgot to breathe for a minute there. Sorry." I took another deep breath. She eyed me doubtfully. "You forgot to breathe? I was trying to be careful." Suddenly she was angry. "What am I supposed to do with you, Bo? Yesterday I kiss you and you attack me. Today you pass out. Sorry." She sighed deeply, then darted in suddenly to kiss my forehead. "It's a good thing that it's physically impossible for me to have a heart attack," she grumbled. "That is good," I agreed. "I can't take you anywhere like this." "No, I'm fine, really. Totally back to normal. Besides, your family is going to think I'm insane anyway, so what's the difference if I'm a little unsteady?" She frowned. "You mean more unsteady than usual?" "Sure. Look, I'm trying not to think about what we're going to do now, so it would help if we could get going." She shook her head, but took my hand and pulled me out of the chair. This time she didn't even ask. She just headed straight for the driver's side of my truck. I figured there was no point in arguing after my latest embarrassing episode. And anyway, I had no idea where she lived. She drove respectfully, without any complaints about what my truck could handle. She took us north out of town, over the bridge at the Kalawah River, and continued till we were past all the houses and on to close-packed trees. I was starting to wonder how far we were going when she abruptly steered right onto an unpaved road. The turnoff was unmarked and almost totally hidden by thick ferns. The trees leaned close on both sides, so you could only see a few yards ahead before the road twisted out of sight. We drove down this road for at least a few miles, mostly east. I was trying to fit this lane into the vague map I had in my head, not very successfully, when there was suddenly some thinning of the forest. She drove into a meadow, or was it a lawn? It didn't get much brighter, though. There were six enormous cedars, maybe the biggest trees I'd ever seen, whose branches shaded an entire acre. They pushed right up against the house in the middle of the lawn, hiding it. I don't know what I expected, but it definitely wasn't this. The house was probably 100 years old, 3 stories high and kind of graceful, if that word could be applied to a house. It was painted a soft, faded white, and all the windows and doors looked original, but they were probably in too good shape for that to be true. My truck was the only car in sight. When Edith shut off the engine, I could hear the sound of a river somewhere close by. "Wow. You like it? It's really something." Suddenly, she was outside my door. I opened it slowly, starting to feel the nerves I'd been trying to suppress. "Are you ready?"
"Nope."
"Let's do this." She laughed, and I tried to laugh with her, but the sound seemed to get stuck in my throat. I mashed my hair flat. "You look great," she said, then took my hand casually, like she didn't even have to think about it anymore. It wasn't a big thing, but it distracted me, made me feel just a little bit less panicky. We walked through the deep shade up to the porch. I knew she could feel my tension. She reached across her body to put her free hand on my forearm for a second. Then she opened the front door and walked inside, towing me behind her. The inside was even less like what I was expecting than the outside. It was very bright, very open, and very big. It must have started out as several rooms, but most of the walls had been removed from the first floor to create one wide space. The back south-facing wall had been entirely replaced with glass. Past the cedars, the lawn was open, and it stretched down to a wide river. A massive staircase dominated the west side of the room. The walls, the high ceiling, the wooden floors, and the thick carpets were all different shades of white. Edith's parents were waiting for us. They stood just to the left of the door on a little platform in front of a huge grand piano. It was also white. I'd seen Dr. Cullen before, of course, but it hit me again how young she was, and how outrageously beautiful. She was holding hands with Ernest, I assumed. He was the only one of the family I'd never seen before. He seemed about the same age as Dr. Cullen, maybe a few years older, and had the same pale, perfect features as the rest of them. He had wavy hair, the color of caramel, a few inches longer than mine. There was something really kind about his face, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was that made me think that. They were both dressed casually in light colors that matched the inside of the house. They smiled, but made no move to approach. I thought they were probably trying not to scare me. "Corrine, Ernest, this is Beau," Edith said. "You're very welcome, Beau." Corrine stepped forward, slow and careful. She raised her hand hesitantly. I stepped forward to shake, and I was kind of surprised by how okay it felt to do that. Maybe it was because she reminded me of Edith in a lot of ways. "It's nice to see you again, Dr. Cullen." "Please, call me Corrine." I grinned at her, surprised that I felt pretty confident. "Corrine," I repeated. Edith squeezed my hand lightly. Ernest stepped forward as well, offering his hand. His cold, stone grasp was just what I expected. "It's very nice to know you," he said sincerely. "Thank you. I'm glad to meet you too." And I was. This felt right. This was Edith's home, her family. It was good to be a part of it. "Where are Archie and Jess?" Edith asked. No one answered, because they had just appeared at the top of the stairs. "Hey, Edie's home," Archie called. And then he streaked down the stairs, just a blur of pale skin, coming to a sudden stop right in front of us. I saw Corrine and Ernest shoot warning glances at him, but I kind of liked it. It was natural for him, how they moved when they didn't have to worry about strangers watching. "Beau," he greeted me, enthusiastic, like we were old friends. He held out his hand, and when I went to shake it, he pulled me into one of those one-armed bro hugs, thumping me lightly on the back. "Hey, Archie," I said. My voice sounded winded. I was shocked, but also a little pleased that he really did seem supportive. More than that, like he already liked me. When he stepped back, I saw that I wasn't the only one who was shocked. Corrine and Ernest were watching my face with wide eyes, like they were waiting for me to make a run for it. Edith's jaw was locked, but I couldn't tell if she was worried or mad. "You do smell good. I never noticed before," Archie commented. My face got hot, and then hotter when I thought what that must look like to them, and nobody seemed to know what to say. Then Jessamine was there. Edith had compared herself to a hunting lion, which was hard for me to picture, but I could easily picture Jessamine that way. There was something like a lion about her now, when she was just standing there. But despite that, I was suddenly totally comfortable. It felt like I was in my own place, surrounded by people I knew well. Easy, kind of like when Jules was around. It was strange to feel that here, and then I remembered what Edith had told me about what Jessamine could do. That was weird to think about. It didn't feel like someone was using magic or whatever on me. "Hello, Beau," Jessamine said. She didn't approach or offer to shake my hand, but it didn't feel awkward. "Hello, Jessamine." I smiled at her, and then the others. "It's nice to meet you all. You have a very beautiful home," I added conventionally. "Thank you," Ernest said. "We're so glad that you came." He spoke with feeling, and I realized that he thought I was brave. I also realized that Royal and Eleanor were nowhere to be seen, and while I was relieved, I was also kind of disappointed. It would have been nice to get that out of the way with Jessamine here, making me feel calm. I noticed Corrine gazing meaningfully at Edith with a pretty intense expression. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Edith nod just slightly. I felt like I was eavesdropping, so I looked away. My eyes wandered over to the beautiful piano on the platform. I suddenly remembered a childhood fantasy that, when I was older and somehow a millionaire, I was going to buy a grand piano for my mother. She wasn't really good. She only played for herself on our second-hand upright. But I loved to watch her play. She was happy, absorbed. She seemed like a new, mysterious person to me then. She'd put me in lessons, of course, but like most kids, I whined until she let me quit. Ernest noticed my stare. "Do you play?" he asked. I shook my head. "Not at all, but it's really beautiful. Is it yours?" "No," he laughed. "Didn't Edith tell you she was musical?" She hasn't mentioned it. But I guess I should have known, right?" Ernest raised his eyebrows, confused. "Is there anything she's not good at?" I asked rhetorically. Jessamine barked out a laugh. Archie rolled his eyes, and Ernest gave Edith a very fatherly look, which was impressive considering how young he seemed. "I hope you haven't been showing off," he said. "It's rude." "Oh, just a little bit." Edith laughed. The sound was infectious. And everyone smiled, including me. Ernest smiled the widest, though, and he and Edith shared a brief look. "Edith, you should play for him," Ernest said. "You just said showing off was rude."
"Make an exception."
He smiled at me.
"I'm being selfish. She doesn't play enough, and I love to hear her."
"I'd like to hear you play," I told her. She gave Ernest a long, exasperated look, then turned the same look on me. When that was done, she dropped my hand and walked up to sit on the bench. She patted the spot next to her and then looked back at me. "Oh," I mumbled, and went to join her. As soon as I sat down, her fingers started flowing across the keys, filling the room with a piece so complex and full it was impossible to believe only one person was playing. My mouth fell open in shock, and I heard chuckling behind me. Edith looked at me casually while the music surged around us without a break. "Do you like it?" I got it immediately. "Of course." "You wrote this." She nodded. "It's Ernest's favorite." And I sighed. "What's wrong?" "I'm just feeling a little insignificant." She thought about that for a minute, and then the music changed slowly into something softer, something familiar. It was the lullaby she'd hummed to me, only 1,000 times more intricate. "I thought of this one," she said quietly, "while I watched you sleeping. It's your song." The song turned even softer and sweeter. I couldn't speak. Then her voice was normal again. They like you quite a bit, you know. Ernest especially. I glanced behind me, and the big room was empty. Where did they go? Giving us some privacy. Subtle, aren't they? I laughed, then frowned. It's nice that they like me. I like them. But Royal and Eleanor... Her expression tightened. Don't worry about Royal. He's always the last to come around. Eleanor? She laughed sharply. Elle thinks I'm a lunatic, it's true, but she doesn't have a problem with you. She's off trying to reason with Royal now. What did I do? I had to ask. I mean, I've never even spoken to... You didn't do anything, Beau, honestly. Royal struggles the most with what we are. It's hard for him to have someone on the outside know the truth. And he's a little jealous. Huh! She shrugged. You're human. He wishes he were too. That brought me up short. Oh. I listened to the music. My music. It kept changing and evolving, but the heart of it stayed the same. I wasn't sure how she did it. She didn't seem to be paying much attention to her hands. That thing Jessamine does feels really... not strange, I guess. It was kind of incredible. She laughed. Words don't fully do it justice, do they? Not really. But does she like me? She seemed... That was my fault. I told you she was the most recent to try our way of life. I warned her to keep her distance. Oh. Indeed. I worked hard not to shudder. Corrine and Ernest think you're wonderful, she told me. Huh. I really didn't do anything very exciting. Shook a few hands. They're happy to see me happy. Ernest probably wouldn't care if you had a third eye and webbed feet. All this time he's been worrying about me, afraid I was too young when Corrine changed me, that there was something missing from my essential makeup. He's so relieved. Every time I touch you, he practically bursts into applause. Archie's enthusiastic. She made a face. Archie has his own special perspective on life. I looked at her for a moment, weighing her expression. What? She asked. You're not going to explain what you mean by that, are you? Her eyes narrowed as she stared back at me, and a moment of wordless communication passed between us. Almost like what I'd seen between her and Corrine before, except without the benefit of mind reading. I knew she wasn't telling me something about Archie, something her attitude toward him had been hinting at for a long time. And she knew that I knew, but she wasn't going to give anything away. Not now. Okay, I said, like we'd spoken all that out loud. Hmm, she said. And because I'd just thought of it. So what was Corrine telling you before? She was looking at the keys now. You noticed that, did you? I shrugged. Of course. She stared at me thoughtfully for a moment before she answered. She wanted to tell me some news. She didn't know if it was something I would share with you. Will you? It's probably a good idea. My behavior might be a little odd for the next few days. Or weeks. A little maniacal. So it's best if I explain myself beforehand. What's wrong? Nothing's wrong, exactly. Archie just sees some visitors coming soon. They know we're here, and they're curious. Visitors? Yes, like us, but not. Their hunting habits are not like ours, I mean. They probably won't come into town at all, but I won't be letting you out of my sight till they're gone. Wow. Shouldn't we... I mean, is there a way to warn people? Her face was serious and sad. Corrine will ask them not to hunt nearby, as a courtesy, and most likely they won't have a problem with that. but we can't do more for a variety of reasons. She sighed. They won't be hunting here, but they'll be hunting somewhere. That's just how things are when you live in a world with monsters. I shivered. Finally, a rational response, she murmured. I was beginning to think you had no sense of self-preservation at all. I let that one pass, looking away, my eyes wandering again around the big white room.
It's not what you expected, is it? She asked, and her voice was amused again.
No, I admitted.
No coffins, no piled skulls in the corners. I don't even think we have cobwebs. What a disappointment this must be for you.
I ignored her teasing. I didn't expect it to be so light and so open. She was more serious when she answered.
It's the one place we never have to hide.
My song drifted to an end, the final chords shifting to a more melancholy key. The last note lingered for a long moment, and something about the sound of that single note was so sad that a lump formed in my throat. I cleared it out, then said, "Thank you." It seemed like the music had affected her, too. She stared searchingly at me for a long moment, and then she shook her head and sighed.
"Would you like to see the rest of the house?" she asked.
"Will there be piled skulls in any corners?"
"Sorry to disappoint."
"Well, okay, but my expectations are pretty low now." We walked up the wide staircase hand in hand. My free hand trailed along the satin-smooth rail. The hall at the top of the stairs was paneled in wood the same pale color as the floorboards. She gestured as we passed the doors. "Royal and Eleanor's room, Corrine's office, Archie's room." She would have continued, but I stopped dead at the end of the hall, staring with raised eyebrows at the ornament hanging on the wall above my head. Edith laughed at my expression.
"Ironic, I know," she said.
"It must be very old," I guessed. I kind of wanted to touch it, to see if the dark patina was as silky as it looked, but I could tell it was pretty valuable. She shrugged.
"Early 1630s, more or less."
I looked away from the cross to stare at her.
"Why do you have this here?"
"Nostalgia. It belonged to Corrine's father." "He collected antiques?"
"No. He carved this himself. It hung on the wall above the pulpit in the vicarage where he preached."
I turned back to stare at the cross while I did the mental math. The cross was over 370 years old. The silence stretched on as I struggled to wrap my mind around the concept of so many years.
"Are you all right?"
she asked.
"How old is Corrine?"
I asked quietly, still staring up.
"She just celebrated her 362nd birthday," Edith said.
She watched my expression carefully as she continued, and I tried to pull it together. "Corrine was born in London in the 1640s, she believes. Time wasn't marked as accurately then, for the common people anyway. It was just before Cromwell's rule, though." The name pulled up a few disjointed facts in my head, from a world history class I'd had last year. I should have paid more attention. "She was the only daughter of an Anglican pastor. Her mother died in childbirth. Her father was a hard man, driven. He believed very strongly in the reality of evil. He led hunts for witches, werewolves, and vampires." It was strange how the word shifted things, made the story sound less like a history lesson. "They burned a lot of innocent people. Of course, the real creatures that he sought were not so easy to catch. Corrine did what she could to protect those innocents. She was always a believer in the scientific method, and she tried to convince her father to look past superstition to true evidence. He discouraged her involvement. He did love her, and those who defended monsters were often lumped in with them. Her father was persistent and obsessive. Against the odds, he tracked some evidence of real monsters. Corrine begged him to be careful, and he listened to an extent. Rather than charge in blindly, he waited and watched for a long time. He spied on a coven of true vampires who lived in the city sewers, only coming out by night to hunt. In those days, when monsters were not just myths and legends, that was the way many lived. His people gathered their pitchforks and torches, of course. She laughed darkly, and waited where the pastor had seen the monsters exit into the street. There were two access points. The pastor and a few of his men poured a vat of burning pitch into one, while the others waited beside the second for the monsters to emerge. I realized I was holding my breath again, and made myself exhale. Nothing happened. They waited a long time and then left disappointed. The pastor was angry. There must have been other exits, and the vampires had obviously fled in fear. Of course, the men with their crude spears and axes weren't any kind of danger to a vampire, but he didn't know that. Now that they were warned, how would he ever find his monsters again? Her voice got lower. It wasn't hard. He must have annoyed them. Vampires can't afford notoriety. Or these probably would have simply massacred the entire mob. Instead, one of them followed him home. Corrine remembers the night clearly, for a human memory. It was the kind of thing that would stick in your mind. Her father came home very late, or rather very early. Corrine had waited up, worried. He was furious, ranting and raving about his loss. Corrine tried to calm him, but he ignored her. And then there was a man in the middle of their small room. Corrine says he was ragged, dressed like a beggar, but his face was beautiful and he spoke in Latin. Because of her father's vocation and her own curiosity, Corrine was unusually educated for a woman in those days. She understood what the man said. He told her father that he was a fool, and he would pay for the damage he had caused. The preacher threw himself in front of his daughter to protect her. I often wonder about that moment. If he hadn't revealed what he loved most, would all our stories have changed? She was thoughtful for a few seconds, and then she continued. The vampire smiled. He told the preacher, "Go to your hell knowing this, that what you love will become all that you hate." He tossed the preacher to the side and grabbed Corrine. She'd seemed lost in the story, but now she stopped short. Her eyes came back to the present, and she looked at me like she'd said something wrong. Or maybe she thought she'd upset me. "What happened?" I whispered. When she spoke, it was like she was choosing each word carefully. He made sure that the preacher knew what would happen to Corrine, and then he killed the preacher very slowly while Corrine watched, writhing in pain and horror. I recoiled. She nodded in sympathy. The vampire left. Corrine knew her fate if someone found her in this condition. Anything infected by the monster would have to be destroyed. She acted instinctively to save her own life. Despite the pain she was in, she crawled into the cellar and buried herself in a pile of rotting potatoes for 3 days. It's a miracle she was able to keep silent, to stay undiscovered. It was over then, and she realized what she had become. I wasn't sure what my face was doing, but she suddenly broke off again. "How are you feeling?" she asked. "I'm good. What happened next?" She half smiled at my intensity, then turned back down the hall, pulling me with her. "Come on then," she said. "I'll show you." Chapter 16. Corrine. She led me back to the room that she'd pointed out as Corrine's office. She paused outside the door for a second. "Come in," Corrine called from inside. Edith opened the door to a tall room with long windows that stretched the entire height of the walls. The room was lined by bookshelves reaching to the ceiling and holding more books than I'd ever seen outside a library. Corinne sat behind a huge desk. She was just placing a bookmark in the pages of the book she held. The room was how I'd always imagined a college dean's would look. Only Corinne looked too young to fit the part. Knowing what she'd been through, having just watched it all in my imagination, while knowing that my imagination wasn't up to the job and it was probably much worse than I'd pictured it, made me look at her differently. "What can I do for you?" she asked with a smile, rising from her seat. "I wanted to show Beau some of our history," Edith said. "Well, your history, actually." "We didn't mean to disturb you," I apologized. "Not at all," she said to me, and then to Edith. "Where are you going to start?" "The Wagoner," Edith said. She pulled me around in a circle so that we were facing the door we just walked through. This wall was different from the others. Instead of bookshelves, it was covered by dozens and dozens of framed paintings. They were all different sizes and styles, some dull, some blazing with color. I scanned quickly, looking for some kind of logic, something they all had in common, but I couldn't find any link. Edith pulled me to the far left side, then put both her hands on my arms and positioned me directly in front of one of the paintings. My heart reacted the way it always did when she touched me, even in the most casual way. It was more embarrassing knowing Corinne would hear it too. The painting she wanted me to look at was a small square canvas in a plain wooden frame. It did not stand out among the bigger and brighter pieces. Painted in different shades of brown, it showed a miniature city full of steeply slanted roofs. A river filled the foreground, crossed by a bridge covered with structures that looked like tiny cathedrals. "London in the 1650s, Edith said. "The London of my youth," Corinne added from a few feet behind us. I jumped a little. I hadn't heard her approach. Edith took my hand and squeezed it lightly. "Will you tell the story?" Edith asked. I turned to see Corinne's reaction. She met my glance and smiled. "I would, but I'm actually running a bit late. The hospital called this morning. Dr. Snow is taking a sick day. But Beau won't miss anything." She smiled at Edith now. "You know the stories as well as I do." It was a strange combination to absorb. The everyday life of a small-town doctor mixed up with a discussion of her early days in 17th-century London. It was also kind of unsettling to realize that she probably was only speaking out loud for my benefit. With another warm smile, Corinne left the room. I stared at the picture of her hometown for a long minute. "What came next?" I asked again. "When she knew what had happened to her." She nudged me over a half step, her eyes on a bigger landscape. It was done in dull fall colors and showed an empty meadow and a gloomy forest, a black mountain peak in the distance. "When she knew what she had become," Edith said quietly, "she despaired and then rebelled. She tried to destroy herself, but that's not easily done." "How?" I didn't mean to say that out loud, but I was so shocked it slipped out. Edith shrugged. "She jumped from great heights. She tried to drown herself in the ocean, but she was young to the new life and very strong. It is amazing that she was able to resist feeding while she was still so new. The instinct is more powerful then. It takes over everything. But she was so repelled by herself that she had the strength to try to kill herself with starvation." "Is that possible?" I asked quietly. "No, there are very few ways we can be killed." I opened my mouth to ask, but she spoke before I could. "So she grew very hungry, and eventually weak. She strayed as far as she could from the human populace, recognizing that her willpower was weakening too. For months she wandered by night, seeking the loneliest places, loathing herself. One night, a herd of deer passed beneath her hiding place. She was so wild with thirst that she attacked without a thought. Her strength returned, and she realized there was an alternative to being the vile monster she feared. Had she not eaten venison in her former life? Over the next months, her new philosophy was born. She could exist without being a demon. She found herself again. She began to make better use of her time. She had always been intelligent, eager to learn. Now she had unlimited time before her. She studied by night, planned by day. She swam to France and...
She swam to France?
People swim the channel all the time, Beau, she reminded me patiently. That's true, I guess. It just sounded funny in that context. Go on. Swimming is easy for us. Everything is easy for you, I muttered. She waited with her eyebrows raised. Sorry, I won't interrupt again, I promise. She smiled darkly and finished her sentence. Because technically we don't need to breathe.
No,
you promised. She laughed, placing her cold finger against my lips. Do you want to hear the story or not?
You can't spring something like that on me and then expect me not to say anything, I mumbled against her finger.
She lifted her hand, moving it to rest against my chest. The speed of my heart reacted to that, but I ignored it. You don't have to breathe? I demanded. No, it's not necessary. Just a habit. She shrugged.
How long can you go without breathing?
Indefinitely, I suppose. I don't know. It gets a bit uncomfortable being without a sense of smell.
A bit uncomfortable, I echoed.
I wasn't paying attention to my own expression, but something in it made her suddenly serious. Her hand fell to her side and she stood very still, watching my face. The silence stretched out. Her features turned to stone. What is it? I whispered, carefully touching her frozen face. Her face came back to life, and she smiled a tiny, wan smile. I know that at some point, something I tell you or something you see is going to be too much. And then you'll run away from me, screaming as you go. Her smile faded. I won't stop you when that happens. I want it to happen, because I want you to be safe. And yet, I want to be with you. The two desires are impossible to reconcile. She trailed off, staring at my face. I'm not running anywhere, I promised. We'll see, she said, smiling again. I frowned at her. Back to the story. Corinne was swimming to France. She paused, settling into the story again. Reflexively, her eyes flickered to another picture, the most colorful of them all, the most ornately framed, and the largest. It was twice as wide as the door it hung next to. The canvas overflowed with bright figures in swirling robes, writhing around long pillars and off marbled balconies. I couldn't tell if it represented Greek mythology or if the characters floating in the clouds above were meant to be biblical. Corinne swam to France and continued on through Europe, to the universities there. By night she studied music, science, medicine, and found her calling, her penance, in that, in saving human lives. Her expression became reverent. I can't adequately describe the struggle. It took Corinne 2 centuries of torturous effort to perfect her self-control. Now she is all but immune to the scent of human blood, and she is able to do the work she loves without agony. She finds a great deal of peace there at the hospital. Edith stared off into space for a long moment. Suddenly she seemed to remember the story. She tapped her finger against the huge painting in front of us. She was studying in Italy when she discovered the others there. They were much more civilized and educated than the wraiths of the London sewers. She pointed up to a comparatively dignified group of figures painted on the highest balcony, looking down calmly on the mayhem below them.
I looked carefully at the little assembly and realized, with a startled laugh, that I recognized the golden-haired woman standing off to one side. Solomino was greatly inspired by Corrine's friends. He often painted them as gods. Edith laughed. Sulpicia, Marcus, and Athenodora, she said, indicating the other three. Nighttime patrons of the arts. The first woman and man were black-haired. The second woman was pale blonde. All wore richly colored gowns, while Corrine was painted in white. What about that one? I asked, pointing to a small, nondescript girl with light brown hair and clothes. She was on her knees, clinging to the other woman's skirts, the woman with the elaborate black curls. Melee, she said. Servant, I suppose you could call her. Sulpicia's little thief. What happened to them? I wondered aloud, my fingertip hovering a centimeter from the figures on the canvas. They're still there, she shrugged, as they have been for millennia. Corrine stayed with them only for a short time, just a few decades. She admired their civility, their refinement, but they persisted in trying to cure her aversion to her natural food source, as they called it. They tried to persuade her, and she tried to persuade them, to no avail. Eventually, Corrine decided to try the new world. She dreamed of finding others like herself. She was very lonely, you see. She didn't find anyone for a long time, but as monsters became the stuff of fairy tales, she found she could interact with unsuspecting humans as if she were one of them. She began working as a nurse. Though her learning and skill exceeded that of the surgeons of the day, as a woman, she couldn't be accepted in another role. She did what she could to save patients from less able doctors when no one was looking. But though she worked closely with humans, the companionship she craved evaded her. She couldn't risk familiarity. When the influenza epidemic hit, she was working nights in a hospital in Chicago. She'd been turning over an idea in her mind for several years, and she had almost decided to act. Since she couldn't find a companion, she would create one. She wasn't sure which parts of her own transformation were actually necessary, and which were simply for the enjoyment of her sadistic creator, so she was hesitant. And she was loath to steal anyone's life the way hers had been stolen. It was in that frame of mind that she found me. There was no hope for me. I was left in a ward with the dying. She had nursed my parents and knew I was alone. She decided to try. Her voice, nearly a whisper now, trailed off. She stared unseeingly through the long windows. I wondered which images filled her mind now. Corrine's memories or her own. I waited. She turned back to me, smiling softly. And now we've come full circle. So you've always been with Corrine? Almost always. She took my hand again and pulled me back out into the hallway. I looked back toward the pictures I couldn't see anymore, wondering if I'd ever get to hear the other stories. She didn't add anything as we walked down the hall, so I asked, Almost? Edith sighed, pursed her lips, and then looked up at me from the corner of her eye. You don't want to answer that, do you? I said. It wasn't my finest hour. We started up another flight of stairs. You can tell me anything. She paused when we got to the top of the stairs and stared into my eyes for a few seconds. I suppose I owe you that. You should know who I am. I got the feeling that what she was saying now was directly connected to what she'd said before, about me running away screaming. I carefully set my face and braced myself. She took a deep breath. I had a typical bout of rebellious adolescence, about 10 years after I was born, created, whatever you want to call it. I wasn't sold on Corrine's life of abstinence, and I resented her for curbing my appetite. So I went off on my own for a time. Really? This didn't shock me the way she thought it would. It only made me more curious. That doesn't repulse you?
No.
Why not?
I guess it sounds reasonable. She laughed one sharp laugh and then started pulling me forward again, through a hall similar to the one downstairs, walking slowly. From the time of my new birth, I had the advantage of knowing what everyone around me was thinking, both human and non-human alike. That's why it took me 10 years to defy Corrine. I could read her perfect sincerity, understand exactly why she lived the way she did. It took me only a few years to return to Corrine and recommit to her vision. I thought I would be exempt from the depression that accompanies a conscience. Because I knew the thoughts of my prey, I could pass over the innocent and pursue only the evil. If I followed a murderer down a dark alley where he stalked a young girl, if I saved her, then surely I wasn't so terrible. I tried to imagine what she was describing. What would she have looked like, coming silent and pale out of the shadows? What would the murderer have thought when he saw her? Perfect, beautiful, more than human. Would he even have known to be afraid? But as time went on, I began to see the monster in my eyes. I couldn't escape the debt of so much human life taken, no matter how justified. And I went back to Corrine and Ernest. They welcomed me back like the prodigal. It was more than I deserved. We'd come to a stop in front of the last door in the hall. "My room," she said, opening it and pulling me through. Her room faced south, with a wall-sized window like the great room below. The whole backside of the house must be glass. Her view looked down on the wide, winding river, which I figured had to be the sole duck, and across the forest to the white peaks of the Olympic mountain range. The mountains were much closer than I would have thought. Her western wall was covered with shelf after shelf of CDs. The room was better stocked than a music store. In the corner was a sophisticated-looking sound system, the kind I was afraid to touch because I'd be sure to break something. There was no bed, only a deep black leather sofa. The floor was covered with a thick, gold-colored carpet, and the walls were upholstered with heavy fabric in a slightly darker shade. "Good acoustics?" I guessed. She laughed and nodded. She picked up a remote and turned the stereo on. It was quiet, but the soft jazz number sounded like the band was in the room with us. I went to look at her mind-boggling music collection. "How do you have these organized?" I asked, unable to find any rhyme or reason to the titles.
"By year, and then by personal preference within that frame," she said absently.
I turned, and she was looking at me with an expression in her eyes that I couldn't read.
"What?"
I was prepared to feel relieved, having you know about everything, not needing to keep secrets from you. But I didn't expect to feel more than that. I like it. It makes me happy. She shrugged and smiled. "I'm glad," I said, smiling back. I'd worried that she might regret telling me these things. It was good to know that wasn't the case. But then, as her eyes dissected my expression, her smile faded and her eyebrows pulled together. "You're still waiting for the running and the screaming, aren't you?" I asked. She nodded, fighting a smile. "I really hate to burst your bubble, but you're just not as scary as you think you are. I honestly can't imagine being afraid of you," I said casually. She raised her eyebrows, and then a slow smile started spreading across her face.
"You probably shouldn't have said that," she told me.
And then she growled, a low sound that ripped up the back of her throat and didn't sound human at all. Her smile got wider until it changed from a smile into a display of teeth. Her body shifted, and she was half crouched, her back stretched long and curved in, like a cat tense to pounce.
Edith?
I didn't see her attack. It was much too fast. I couldn't even understand what was happening. For
For half a second, I was airborne, and the room rolled around me, upside down and then right side up again. I didn't feel the landing, but suddenly I was on my back on the black couch, and Edith was on top of me, her knees tight against my hips, her hands planted on either side of my head so that I couldn't move, and her bared teeth just inches from my face. She made another soft noise that was halfway between a growl and a purr.
"Wow," I breathed.
"You were saying?" she asked.
That you are a very, very terrifying monster?"
She grinned.
"Much better. And that I am so completely in love with you."
Her face went soft, her eyes wide, all the walls down again.
"Bo,"
she whispered.
"Can we come in?"
a low voice asked from the door. I flinched, and probably would have smacked my forehead against Edith's if she hadn't been so much faster than I was. In another fraction of a second, she'd pulled me up so that I was sitting on the sofa and she was next to me, her legs draped over mine. Archie stood in the doorway, Jessamine behind him in the hall. Red started creeping up my neck, but Edith was totally relaxed.
"Please," she said to Archie.
Archie didn't seem to have noticed that we were doing anything unusual. He walked to the center of the room and folded himself onto the floor in a motion so graceful it was kind of surreal. Jessamine stayed by the door, and unlike Archie, she looked a little shocked. She stared at Edith's face, and I wondered what the room felt like to her.
"It sounded like you were having Beau for lunch," Archie said. "And we came to see if you would share."
I stiffened until I saw Edith grin. Whether because of Archie's comment or my reaction, I couldn't tell.
"Sorry," she replied, throwing a possessive arm around my neck. "I'm not in a mood to share."
Archie shrugged.
"Fair enough."
"Actually," Jessamine said, taking a hesitant step into the room. "Archie says there's going to be a real storm tonight, and Eleanor wants to play ball. Are you game?"
The words were all normal, but I didn't quite understand the context. It sounded like Archie might be a little more reliable than the weatherman, though. Edith's eyes lit up, but she hesitated.
"Of course you should bring Beau," Archie said.
I thought I saw Jessamine throw a quick glance at him.
"Do you want to go?"
Edith asked. Her expression was so eager that I would have agreed to anything.
"Sure, where are we going?"
"We have to wait for Thunder to play ball. You'll see why," she promised.
"Should I bring an umbrella?"
All three of them laughed out loud.
"Should he?"
Jessamine asked Archie.
"No."
Archie seemed positive.
"The storm will hit over town. It'll be dry enough in the clearing."
"Good,"
Jessamine said. And the enthusiasm in her voice was, unsurprisingly, catching. I found myself getting excited about the idea, though I wasn't even sure what it was.
"Let's call Corrine and see if she's in," Archie said.
And he was on his feet in another liquid movement that made me stare.
"Like you don't already know," Jessamine teased.
And then they were gone.
"So, what are we playing?" I asked.
"You will be watching," Edith clarified. "We will be playing baseball."
I looked at her skeptically.
"Vampires like baseball?"
She smiled up at me.
"It's the American pastime."
Chapter 17. The Game. It was just beginning to rain when Edith turned onto my street. Up until that moment, I'd had no doubt that she'd be staying with me while I spent a few hours in the real world. And then I saw the black, weathered sedan parked in Charlie's driveway, and heard Edith mutter something angry under her breath. Leaning away from the rain under the shallow front porch, Jules Black stood behind her mother's wheelchair. Bonnie's face was impassive as rock while Edith parked my truck against the curb. Jules stared down, looking mortified. Edith's low voice was furious. "This is crossing the line." She came to warn Charlie? I guessed, more horrified than angry. Edith just nodded, answering Bonnie's stare with narrowed eyes. At least Charlie wasn't home yet. Maybe the disaster could be averted. "Let me deal with this," I suggested. Edith's glare looked a little too serious. I was surprised.